Okay, call the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order for March 15th, 2012 at, and I apologize, 1:49 p.m. With me today is Senator Menard, Senator Davis, and myself, Chair Senator Egan. The other two members of Labor and Commerce were upstairs with me, and we weren't paying attention to time and hearing about oil tax legislation, and so I apologize for getting such a late start, and hopefully Senator Pasquin and Senator Giesel will be joining us later. First off, we do have a special presentation and on how equality policies work to strengthen economies and the labor force, and we're pleased to welcome a Montana State Senator, Christine Coffin. Christine, Senator Coffin, welcome to Alaska, and we look forward to your presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to appear in front of you today on this important topic. I want to thank those that are sponsored our travel to get here, the Alliance for Reproductive Justice, and my activist and lobbyist, Jamie Greer. I'm going to share some of the time with him about this important issue as well. And they've invited us to speak to a number of in a number of settings to the Women's Summit that's occurring here at this time. So thank you again. I was, in addition to being a senator, as you may know, we meet 90 days every 2 years in Montana, and so we all have other jobs. And for a lot of the time, my job was to be the director of the Human Rights Network, which takes a broad view of human rights in Montana, everything from trying to help our communities respond to violence and intimidation that occurs to minority populations, as well as white supremacist rhetoric and activities of groups such as the militia and freemen and so on. So we look at health care as a human right, a broad base of issues. I no longer work there. But I thought it was important to know that I first look at gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender equality as a civil rights issue. But it happens that what's good for human rights is also good for business. Equality really means fairness. And fairness, of course, provides a multitude of intangible benefits to businesses here in Alaska as well as other places. Recognizing the relationships that all employees have means a much more open and innovative business climate that ensures fundamental fairness and basic civil rights for all. And that's the kind of workplace many, many people are looking for. I think Alaska has an opportunity, as many states do, but Alaska could lead by embracing non-discrimination policies, ensuring that all employees and shareholders and consumers can live their lives to the fullest potential. You should not underestimate what it means to a gay or lesbian employee to live in fear that they might lose their job should their family life become known and a topic of conversation among their colleagues. I think if you put a call out there and said, we want to hear stories of discrimination of gay and lesbian people in the workforce, you would be unlikely to get a lot of people here, in part because people are afraid to do that. I mean, the most casual conversation at the water cooler about a family vacation is always couched in sort of different pronouns or a little bit of secrecy. And it makes employees focus, instead of being productive on their jobs, about how to sort of keep their lives secret from people who may wish them harm or from their supervisors or employers. Equality really benefits corporate recruitment, retention, and morale in the workplace. Demographers have found that the new generation of highly desirable workers are likely to choose where they want to live first and then look for their job. And they often cite diversity and inclusive policies in the workforce as a reason why they want to move to another or move to a community in order to accept employment. I know the discussion in Montana is often quite a bit of concern about why are young people leaving the state for opportunities elsewhere. And again, you shouldn't underestimate the ability for these kinds of policies to help people who might want to come to communities. Whether or not the person is gay or lesbian, they want to feel that there are inclusive policies of diversity in the workforce. And I think for especially young people, where this issue, as you know, has certainly been changing in the culture over the last few decades, and the younger generation is I think much more comfortable than many of us in terms of wanting those kinds of policies present in order to go to work and feel good about the kind of company they've decided to work for. Equality would put Alaska businesses in the strongest and most competitive position to attract and recruit and retain the best and brightest employees and to keep those high-caliber employees in the state. Alaska employers risk losing same-sex couples and their allies to Vancouver or Seattle or other places where these kind of policies are in place. It's very difficult when one member of a couple feels like they have their workplace that is inclusive and they want to be, honest about their lives and their families in that setting, and the other partner lives in a place where he or she fears for her continued employment should these really irrelevant details become known. Worker productivity can increase, I believe, as employees will be able to focus on work rather than their concern around discrimination or equal pay or potential loss of employment. Great states and cities must demonstrate a commitment to creating open, healthy, and equitable environment in which to live and work. Businesses would face lower recruiting costs, expanded pool of qualified candidates if same-sex couples move to or stay in places of business. There's also, I think, some threat of kind of negative publicity around these sorts of issues. In the recent past, two employees of the University of Montana sued the university system because they were denied health benefits for their partners. And that went all the way to the Montana Supreme Court, who ruled in favor of the plaintiffs because the university system had a policy that allowed opposite sex but unmarried couples to receive health benefits. And they said, really, you must treat unmarried couples the same. You cannot discriminate against one over the other. And so, of course, the university system could have decided to eliminate benefits for opposite sex but unmarried partners. But that would have really been taking away a tangible benefit from actually quite a number of people that they had granted it to. And they did make the right choice. And the state of Montana, of which I am an employee as a state senator, followed suit without question because they had the same sort of policy there. And as a result, my partner and I are able to take advantage of policies that make me equal with my colleagues in the Senate so that my family can have the same benefits as my colleagues do. I wish I could say we've been successful in Montana in passing statewide non-discrimination policies. That's not the case. We have tried 10 times over the last two decades to pass additions to our human rights law that would provide non-discrimination policies in employment, housing, benefits, and public accommodations. We have not been successful. But we've had 10 hearings. We feel like we're educating people every time we have those hearings. And the action now really has moved to municipalities, perhaps much like the question five in Anchorage that will be voted on here in the next few weeks. We have one city that has now adopted non-discrimination policies, and other cities are lining up. We're helping them line up. One of the issues, it really does beg for a statewide solution in a lot of ways, because do you really want your citizens receiving different protections based on where they happen to work or where they happen to recreate and go visit? So the reason I ask Jamie Greer to come and chat with you a little bit is because he is on the forefront of the effort to organize in cities across the state of Montana for non-discrimination benefits. So at this point, I'd like to ask him to speak for just a few minutes.
Thanks, Senator. Mr. Greer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll keep my comments very brief. Senator Kaufman had wanted to include me in on this because of my work on a city-by-city level in Montana to pass non-discrimination protections. I worked in the city of Missoula, and I'm currently working in our capital, which is very similar, it feels like, of Helena. And one of the primary components of my job is reaching out to business owners and making sure they understand not just what we are doing and why it's important, but also helping them find ways to come forward in their support and also change their internal policies. And why we're doing this is pretty simple. Right now in Montana, similar to what's happening in Alaska, gay, lesbian, bi, and transgender residents, people who work in our businesses, people who are patrons of our businesses, people who own or rent homes in our communities aren't protected. We're not included in the Montana Human Rights Act. It's a similar thing in Alaska. And we have been approaching businesses with a very clear message of what they're doing by coming forward is not unique, and they're not alone. The vast majority, 89% of Fortune 500 companies in this country, already have workplace policies that protect gay and lesbian individuals. Walmart Stores Incorporated, the largest private employer in the world, recently added transgender people to their policies, their non-discrimination policy. What we're trying to do is by using that list of substantial corporations that are doing business, a lot of them located in the Pacific area, the Pacific Northwest, and the West, we're trying to branch out and build that support on a local level. 190 major businesses achieved the top score of 100 on the Human Rights Campaign's Equality Index, and that can be easily found online. That number simply means that they're major corporations that are taking the steps to protect gay and lesbian employees, and they're doing this because it makes sense in terms of keeping the best and the brightest employees at their corporations. An increasing number of companies, large and small, are reimbursing gay and lesbian employees for the taxes that they pay on health insurance benefits for their spouses and domestic partners, and it's a tax that does not apply to heterosexual married couples. And they're doing that as well to retain the best and brightest employees at their corporations. I'm able to answer any questions about the work we're doing in Montana, how it might apply here. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Greer. We've been joined when you were making your presentation by Senator Giesel and Senator Pasquin. Welcome. So we have a full committee. Questions for the senator or Mr. Greer?
Yes, I have a question.
Senator Menard.
I would pose the question.
Can you move the mic?
Yes. My question is since you've had this advocacy for equality, on a scale from 1 to 10, you started, you said, 10 years ago to be really passionate and involved in this. What today, in 2012, where have you gone from on a scale from 1 to 10 as far as improvement?
No, I would say we've gone from 1 to 7.2. we did pass a non-discrimination bill out of one house of the Senate, not this past year, but in a previous year. This time we also passed a different equality bill related to language that remains in our felony laws regarding same-sex behaviors. And so that passed out of the Senate again. The House is just not very cooperative.
And then one follow-up, Mr. Chairman, if I may.
is on your
one fellow.
Yes.
Across the United States, how many states currently are favorable to the
statewide number and number of cities, maybe?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't know the specific number. I do know that almost 50% of Americans are covered by either statewide protection or municipal protection. The number is very close to 50% of Americans.
Okay. Great. Further questions? Senator Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a question at this time, but I want to say to Senator Hoffman, we're so glad to have you in our state, from one senator to another senator. Sorry you're going to have to leave town very suddenly this afternoon, not tonight. Wish you could stick around for today's activity also. But I want to encourage you in your work and commend you on the work that you've been doing over the years. And even though you've been, how long you been in the Senate now?
I was in the House beginning in 2011. I've been in the Senate 6 years.
Okay.
So, excuse me, 2001, I joined the House.
2001.
6 years, yeah, 2000, yeah.
You came into the Senate in 2001?
I came into the House 2001. I served there 6 years and have now been 6 years in the Senate.
Okay, a little opposite for me. I came to the Senate in 2001. So I'm moving into my 12th year. But thank you, and I hope that we'll get to talk further before you leave.
Thank you very much.
Great. Further questions for Senator Kaufman or Mr. Greer? Senator, thank you very much for coming and testifying today. And again, we apologize for starting late today, but we have.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's great to be in the state. It is my fourth time here, so I like to recreate in your state.
I'm great.
You're more than welcome to cancel your flight.
Oh.
Great. Thank you very much and welcome. Thank you, Mr. Greer. And we do have, and I don't know if we're going to be able to get through all three of these pieces of legislation. However, we will be hearing now Senate Bill 28 under bills, actually they're all bills previously heard or scheduled. Senate Bill 28, Price Gouging Involving Energy Resources, sponsor Senator Wilkowski, and it's our intent to attempt to move it to the next committee referral, which would be Finance. Next up, our House Bill 267, Real Estate Sales Licenses / Commissions. This has no further referral, and we will take further action on this bill. Senate Bill 116, Workers' Comp, Collective Bargaining, Mediation, sponsored by Senate Labor and Commerce, has a further referral to Finance. Senator Wilkowski, Senate Bill 128. Yes. And Mr. Presley, Senate Bill 28. Yes.
Hello, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilkowski, welcome again.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is
Presley. Welcome.
Bill Wilkowski, State Senator serving Northeast Anchorage.
Questions from the committee for Senator Wilkowski? Senator Giesel, do you have an amendment you'd like to present to this?
Do you
have further comments, Senator Wilkowski? I'm sorry.
No, other than I've gotten many, many phone calls in my office supportive of this, none opposing. And I've gotten many emails supportive of this bill and none opposing either, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Wilkowski. Senator Giesel.
Well, Mr. Chair, I believe Mr. Sniffen is online.
From the Department of Law, Mr. Sniffen, and I understand that you must leave by 2:15. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, do we have copies of the amendment?
I understood that you had some conceptual amendment.
I do, Mr. Chair, but Mr. Sniffen has to leave soon. Could I ask him questions first?
Okay, were you going to ask him about your amendment?
No.
Because we'd like to see it.
Absolutely.
Okay, Mr. Sniffen.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator Giesel.
All right, thank you. Mr. Sniffen, have you investigated fuel prices in the past?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, for the record, Ed Sniffen with the Department of Law, and my responsibilities there include enforcement of our antitrust and consumer protection statutes. And in that role, yes, we have. We have investigated fuel prices three times, actually, in the past decade.
So have you found any issues? I mean, what have you uncovered?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, pricing investigations are a little tricky because under our antitrust law, those investigations require that we find evidence of collusion or coordinated conduct. We have retained experts to take a look at the fuel pricing that goes on in the state of Alaska. The details of our investigations are confidential, but we have released a couple of reports that set out our findings, and we haven't found any evidence of illegal activity in the sense that we haven't found any collusion or coordinated conduct either among the refiners or distributors or retailers in the state. And that's one thing about this particular bill that is a good thing, and that is it would remove the requirement that we actually find collusion or coordinated conduct. We could look at conduct to determine if it was just unconscionable. The tricky thing about the bill, though, is I don't know if unconscionability might be any easier to determine than finding collusion or coordinated conduct, but it would certainly allow us to focus our efforts on another area, and that would definitely be a tricky area.
So can you tell me what unconscionable means? Is there a definition anywhere that helps you?
Senator Diesel, through the chair, and I think as Senator Wilikowski pointed out last time, we do have some guidance from some case law on what unconscionability is. I think in the prior iterations of this bill, language like excessive or exorbitant was used, and we discussed that with Senator Wilikowski's office and decided that unconscionability actually would be maybe slightly easier to identify than excessive or exorbitant, only because there are a couple of cases out there that actually define what that means. I don't know that the definition is any any help, because, for example, in Pennsylvania and Ohio, they say unconscionable means something that affronts the sense of justice, decency, and reasonableness. What that means is something that might be tricky. Normally, unconscionability is defined in the context of a price gouging law when there has been some declared state of emergency. And I think, as Senator Wilikowski pointed out, most states' price gouging laws require a declared state of emergency before the laws kick in, because then you have a baseline. You can say, well, look, you've raised your price 300% only because Hurricane Katrina came in and wiped out these people, and you're taking advantage of that situation to gouge consumers. That's the easy call. That's what unconscionable, might be. But in a situation like we have here in Alaska where, because of the state of our market and the lack of competition, retailers and distributors, refiners, really can charge what they like. Well, actually, retailers have a more difficult time doing that because there is competition at that level. But at the refining and distribution level, really no declared state of emergency. What's an unconscionable price? We've just never had to really look at before. It would definitely be tricky. We'd have to study that and try to come up with something.
So at this time, you don't have a process in place for arriving at a determination of unconscionable price?
Senator Giesel, through the chair, no, we don't. We would, we'd have to really think about that. We've never had to look at that before, so this is new territory for us, and we'd have to think about it and come up with a test that the Attorney General was satisfied with that just might shock the conscience and lead you to believe, hey, wait a minute, you shouldn't be charging these prices. And then, of course, the follow-up to that might be if we are going to find that a certain price is unconscionable, the trickier part might be telling people, well, what can we charge then? Because if you're going to tell somebody they can't charge something, I think you should be prepared to tell them what they can charge. And if we just see a price that's completely out of line, someone's making 600% profit or something that just seems absolutely outrageous, are we going to say, well, you can make a 20% profit, 30% profit? I mean, are we going to require an accounting to find out what their costs of providing the product are, what their investment risks are, what their return on capital is, what a reasonable rate of return is? If you get into those kinds of questions, that starts to look a lot like regulation, which is what the RCA does. So we would have to grapple with that, and those are just issues we haven't had to face yet.
Thank you.
Further questions?
I have one further question, and that is on page 2, line 2. It refers to fuel for space heating.
Is this for the bill sponsor or for Mr. Sniffen? the question?
Either one.
Okay.
But it refers to fuel for space heating. Now, in Anchorage, that fuel is natural gas. In other areas, it's diesel. So what is this referring to, and who regulates that price?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, I'll take a quick crack at that, and then I'll let Senator Wilkowski describe what he intended the bill to mean. But most diesel fuel that's used for heating, fuel that is delivered by a tank wagon or a truck, that you know, you fill up your oil tank in Fairbanks or Juneau or in rural Alaska and use that for heating, that's the kind of space heating fuel that I believe would be covered by this bill. But I think you raised a good point in that natural gas could also be considered space heating, and that is something that's regulated by the RCA. The RCA does not regulate fuel oil or prices for fuel oil, but they do regulate natural gas.
So could this then be a conflict in terms of the RCA's regulatory authority over natural gas, this language, fuel for space heating?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, it might be. I guess by default, it would only apply to the commodities that aren't regulated by the RCA. So there might be a technical conflict by using fuel for space heating as the a definition. But I don't know that there would be an actual conflict in the sense that the RCA would not, I think, attempt to regulate this kind of fuel product. And if we thought those prices were unconscionable, this bill would give us the authority to look at that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Senator Giesel. Senator Wilkowski to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on that point, that provision was added in a committee several years ago. It was the Senate Energy Committee, I believe, and there were concerns by, at the time, Senator Hoffman and Senator Stedman, who were members of that committee, who were concerned about high costs in rural Alaska in particular, and in southeast Alaska where you use heating oil or diesel to heat. And it was never the intent to attempt to regulate a energy source that is currently regulated by the RCA.
Okay, thank you, Senator Wilkowski. Senator Pascavant.
If I could ask a question of the person online. You know, you were addressing the issue of both collusion and coordinated conduct and distinguishing that from an unconscionability standard. And if you could, please comment upon the difficulty in applying a collusion or coordinated conduct standard in a smaller, limited market where there may be either an oligopoly or a monopoly. Could you comment upon that?
Certainly, yes, Senator Pascavant, through the chair. In smaller markets, it's very difficult to find illegal collusion or coordinated conduct because, well, first of all, in fuel pricing, prices are displayed for everyone to see. People don't really need to engage in any kind of illegal conduct to know what everyone else is charging. And in smaller communities, this information is just known. And it's very, very difficult to say, hey, you had a meeting with somebody and you agreed to set the price for something. There's really no need for competitors in those kinds of markets to engage in illegal conduct because they just know what everybody's doing and they don't need to do anything illegal to find it out. So coming up with evidence of illegal collusion or coordinated conduct is very tricky. Even in Anchorage, where we find the most robust competition for the sale of gasoline, collusion between retailers is very, very difficult to uncover. I think several years ago, maybe before I even started the department, we did find some evidence of some retailers having meetings and agreeing to fix the price on gasoline, and the Attorney General took action and shut some stations down. But absent, some kind of a mole or a whistleblower who is at some of those meetings to give us that kind of information, it's very difficult to do.
Thank you, Mr. Sniffen. Further questions, Senator Pascavant? Further questions for Mr. Sniffen? Ed, thank you very much for sticking around and going over your deadline that you had to leave, and you can apologize on our behalf. Again, thank you very much, Mr. Sniffen.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Further comments, Senator Wilikowski?
Just a couple of points, Mr. Chairman. We, as I mentioned at the last hearing, originally, when we drafted the bill, we had a specific trigger in there. We said 10% higher than the prices charged in Seattle or Washington. And then people, the refiners didn't like that, and they said, well, that's too specific. You shouldn't tie it to something, even though we had very roughly, very closely tracked that figure for years. They didn't want a specific standard, so we took that out at their request. We put the we originally went to excessive or exorbitant. We were advised by the attorneys that unconscionable was a better standard. It's a standard that's used in other states. It's a standard for which there is a body of legal case law out there. I believe it's a standard that's used in regulatory hearings. I would mention there have been at least two reports from the Attorney General investigating this issue. However, the investigations have been limited to collusion and antitrust. They have not investigated whether or not the prices are unconscionable or not. They simply said there were market forces which could or could not be unconscionable. Well, they didn't say that, but that they could or could not. It just hasn't been investigated. And I just want to point out that this bill, all it does is it empowers the Attorney General. If they believe, the Attorney General believes that there is evidence of very high prices without warrant, then the Attorney General, he or she, has the ability to go investigate it. And if they find that there is evidence that the prices are unconscionable, they can file a lawsuit. And this was another aspect of the bill that was changed, and I'll just say this for the record, that several years ago, again, this was something that DeSoro came to us and said, because originally we had the bill drafted that anyone could file a lawsuit. If anyone believed the prices were unconscionable, any person could file a lawsuit. And at the time, I had a meeting with the representative from DeSoro who said, that's the real problem with the bill. That's the problem that we, that's the, our main concern with the bill is that we don't want to have to fight 100 lawsuits. And so I was told at the time, Mr. Chairman, and I said this on the record 2 years ago when this bill came up, I was told by the representative, if we change that provision to only allow the Attorney General to file a lawsuit, then I was told that they would not oppose the bill. I was told that by DeSoro 2 years ago. The next day, DeSoro came in and opposed the bill after I made the change. So we have very tight restrictions on this bill. This is a bill designed to protect Alaskan consumers. We're not saying that anyone is acting other than they would in the free market. They're going to try to make as much money as they possibly can. And the problem that we have in the state of Alaska is we allow legal price gouging. There's no free market in Alaska. What we're saying is in that situation, we're going to empower the Attorney General to investigate, and if they find evidence of gouging, of unconscionable prices, they have the ability to file a lawsuit. That's all this bill does, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an amendment to propose, and to put it on the table, I will move that SB 28 be amended to include health care, rental housing, and the sale of grocery food items, that they be covered by and subject to the same anti-gouging provisions as the refiners, distributors, and retailers of certain energy resources. Now, I apologize, Mr. Chair, that this is a conceptual amendment. My amendment is still in drafting. I had not anticipated this coming back before the committee so quickly, so I apologize that it is conceptual. I mentioned, I think, I did mention 2 days ago the health care issue. You know, our Department of Administration is struggling with the accelerating costs of health care. We pay 50%, half again more, here in Alaska for our health care than the costs in Seattle. In fact, many insurers are now sending their beneficiaries to Seattle for health care services because the prices are so high here in Alaska. We have heard the same, I have heard the same, about rental housing prices and grocery prices in some locations. And so in keeping with the intent of this bill to look at anti-gouging issues related to really vital services for Alaskans, my amendment proposes adding some additional items to this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you, Senator Giesel. Discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Davis.
I want to discuss an amendment. With such amendment as this, would it not affect the titles to this bill?
It would.
With one source that we're speaking to, and she's added right. several others in here, you'd have to have a title change. And besides that, I want to hear from the sponsor of this.
Senator Walkowski.
Comments are about that.
Thank you,
Senator Davis.
Senator Davis is correct. This would require a title change, number one. I would have concerns with the proposed amendment. I don't believe the state should be in the business of regulating the free market unless it's absolutely necessary. And the significant difference that you have between groceries, for instance, and gasoline prices is you have one place that you can buy gasoline. There's one refiner that refines 80 to 82% of the gasoline in the state. There's one that refines 10%, and there's a couple others that are very tiny percentages. You have an oligopoly when it comes to gasoline and heating fuel in the state of Alaska. If I don't like what they charge me for a dozen eggs or a carton of milk at Safeway, I can go to Fred Meyer, or I can go to any of another dozen stores that are around. If I don't like what my doctor at Providence charges me, I can go to other healthcare doctors all across the state, all across Anchorage, all across Juneau. If I don't like what the landlord charges me on rental property, I've got hundreds of choices of other places I can rent. There is a free market for those items. There's not a free market for gasoline. There's an oligopoly. That's the major difference.
Thank you, Senator Walkowski. Further questions of the sponsor, Senator Giesel.
Well, Mr. Chair, in response to that, actually there are many communities where there are extremely limited grocery opportunities, certainly housing opportunities, and there are certain specialties that have formed groups, and they're the only group in the state of Alaska that offers a particular specialized health care. So it actually does apply to these other vendors. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Giesel.
And Senator Giesel is absolutely correct. There are communities that have small markets, and I think this would be an excellent bill for Senator Giesel to file on its own and take that bill through the committee process, just like I've been taking this bill through the committee process for 3 years. I think that's an excellent bill, Senator Giesel. I would encourage you to go ahead and file that bill on your own.
Further discussion?
On the amendment?
On the amendment.
I have one strong concern about the amendment, and that is that due process hasn't really happened as far as I would like the housing industry to come up and speak to us as a full committee, as well as health care providers. I know the direction of which Senator Giesel is going, and I'm sure it's well thought and meaningful to her that we consider other places where we as individual citizens of Alaska feel gouged. But I think it's way too late, but certainly here at 2:30 we have to all, at least I have somewhere else today to be tackling this amendment.
Okay, thank you, Senator Menard. What's the committee's intention? Do we want to hold this bill over again and get it a draft submitted, or do we want to object to the concept of this amendment now?
I think we vote on the amendment and move forward.
Senator Pasquin, so do you object?
Yes.
Okay. And I'm assuming we take a roll. Kimberg?
Yes.
No.
Senator
Davis? No.
Senator
Pasquin? No. Senator Eaton? No. Action on Senate Bill 28.
Mr. Chair, I would move
Senator Pasquin
that we move Senate Bill 28 from this committee to the next committee, a referral with individual recommendations and attach fiscal note, if any.
Great, thank you. Senator Pasquin.
Mr. Chair,
objection?
I will object and ask for a roll call.
Great. Thank you, Senator Giesel. One more time, Ann.
Senator Menard?
to move this out of committee?
Yes.
Senator Giesel?
No.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Passman?
Yes.
Yes.
Four yeas, one nay.
Great, thank you. And Senate Bill 28 has now gone to its next committee referral, which is Senate Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very much for sticking around, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Madam.
Next on the agenda is House Bill 267, and was original sponsor in the House by Representative Munoz. And to present the bill, Terry Harvey from Representative Munoz's staff. Mr. Harvey, welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Terry Harvey, Representative Munoz, staff. We have before you the House version of this bill that you heard the companion piece a few weeks back, sponsored by the chair, so I know you're somewhat familiar with it. I will use your recommendation, if you'd like me to run through the bill as a refresher very quickly, as briefly as possible, and then move on to the two changes that were made on the House side on this bill. This bill resolves three areas of concern brought to us by the Alaska Realtors Association. It modifies real estate law in one area and offers clarity on several other areas. The modifier, if you will make an exception for charitable organizations. It will allow a licensee to share a part or all of their commission with a charitable organization. This is not allowed under current statutes. It has to do with conflict of interest. A licensee can only share that information with another licensee. What this does is basically make an exception for charitable organizations. We're trying to promote charitable giving within the industry. Another area of clarity that we offer, there's the issue of licensed assistance. Licensees within real estate in Alaska, there was a question of whether or not a licensed assistant could work for more than one brokerage simultaneously, and the Alaska Real Estate Commission had a discussion on this, and the Alaska Real Estate Association felt like some clarifying language within the current statutes would be appropriate to make certain that a licensed assistant could only work for one brokerage at a time. And there's one other area that this bill addresses, and that's the closing down of a brokerage. Currently, if a brokerage must be closed down for, say, a broker falls ill, incapacitated, and or a violation of law, only another licensed broker may be assigned by the Real Estate Commission to perform those functions. What this change does in this law is allow that flexibility with the Real Estate Commission to broaden that to include other licensees like a real estate sales professional. And this was deemed a reasonable concept in that in some areas of Alaska there's only one broker in the entire community or perhaps for many, many miles. And the idea was to allow other licensees to be designated by the commission to come in to perform that function as needed. And what I could also go on to at your discretion, Mr. Chairman, is the changes that were made in judiciary on the House side to this bill. The title was broadened to include the three areas, and this was seemed like a good process move to go ahead and be inclusive and make sure that the bill was reflective. So the title was broadened, and it mentions temporary permits, licensed assistance, and charitable organizations in the title now. Now, the other area that was changed, this was more clarity was added to the licensed assistant language that, again, put one licensed assistant and one brokerage at a time. If you will, sir, with your permission, I would just read one sentence here. It reads now, The licensed assistant is not employed to perform activities requiring licensure under this chapter for more than one licensed real estate broker. And that language was tweaked, if you will, in judiciary. It was felt that it just more clarity to the clarifying language that we began with in the bill. And it was in one section now versus a couple of areas in the statutes. That pretty much covers where we are with this bill today.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Harvey. And you remember this committee heard this bill, passed it, and we passed it out of the Senate, and then you're giving it back to us. And if we do this, we won't have to go to conference, I'm assuming.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harvey. Questions for the presenter?
Just
Senator Pascavant.
What's the Alaska Real Estate Commission's position? I see that there's a number of individual realtors, but is there, or maybe I missed it.
Well, we do have the support on the changes that were made and the bill itself. We do have support from the Alaska Realtors Association. I can't speak for the Real Estate Commission, but in conversations that they had with the association, our understanding is they're in support of these three changes and do support it.
And we do have Mr. Champion in the audience, and he's shaking his head yes.
Mr. Champion is here, and right. He testified before Mr. Chairman, and if there are any questions for him, he could answer
if we need him again.
Okay.
Champion is shaking his head, and that should be great.
No, it's. I just want to make sure there's no serious or significant opposition within the profession.
Through the chair, Senator Pascavant, there's absolutely none that we are aware of at this time.
It on the record.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Harvey. And also, Mr. Habiger is here from the department. Did you want to provide any testimony, Mr. Habiger, or just here to answer questions? Great. Yeah, and I want to clarify, Mr. Champion was turning his head left or right. No, I mean, he was vertical. He was saying yes. Action of the committee. Senator Pascavant.
I would move that we move the second CS for House Bill 267, I believe it's / I version, from this committee to the next committee or referral, and I believe it is with a zero fiscal note.
Through the chair, that is correct, sir.
That's my motion.
Great. Thank you, Senator Pascavant. Is there objection? Seeing we'll take a brief at ease. Reconvene the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee for March 15th, back to order at 2:35. Next and last on the agenda is Senate Bill 116, Workers' Comp, Collective Bargaining, Mediation. Sponsor is the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, has a further referral to Senate Finance. And we will consider an amendment by Senator Giesel.
Do you wish me to review it?
It was moved. Yeah, you can, yes. Senator Giesel.
For simplicity, the addition would allow the individual to choose their own health care provider. It preserves the injured worker's right to choose their health care provider and prevents bargaining away that patient choice. We went through the places where it changes. We could do that again, Mr. Chair, if you wish.
I don't think we need to.
Okay.
Senators, do you want to go through it again? Great. And we do have Linda Hall, Director of Insurance, on the audience. Ms. Hall, would you like to come forward and comment on this bill? Thank you, Director Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I do appreciate this opportunity to. I have a few comments that I would like to make on the bill. I was not in town when you heard the bill before, and my preference is, as all of you, I think, know, to be able to testify in person, so I do apologize that I'm rather late to this hearing. I just wanted to share some concerns I have. I've been working in, while I do workers' compensation insurance, I've also done a lot of work over years with the workers' compensation system and as it affects insurance costs in particular. And I'm concerned that we're looking at a new system that will only apply to employers and employees that are engaged in a collective bargaining arrangement. Approximately 25% of the workforce would be impacted by this bill if they choose to, and they may not choose to do so. I think there are provisions in this bill that could be advantageous to other employers, and I'm not sure why we would adopt something for less than 25% of our workforce. That's an observation. Supporters of SB 116 have alleged there would be claim cost savings, but in working with the Division of Workers' Compensation, we've really not found studies that would support that claim. There was a 2002 University of California, Berkeley study of carve-outs, which have been in the California system since 1993. The study concluded, and I quote, "Overall, carve-outs do not appear to harm employees, sometimes they help. At the same time, data analysis of one carve-out showed it had no effect on cost and dispute rates." Alaska's costs are driven by the high cost of health care, and I think we've talked about that substantially in the past. Currently, 76% of the cost of our system is driven by medical cost. That's in comparison to a 59% average nationwide. That means substantially higher here. If we allow deviation from the current system that has any potential to reduce medical cost, I would like to see it be something that all employers could engage in. One of the things that I've heard as concerns for the bill, and I would certainly support, is that this system could cause a single employer to simultaneously run multiple workers' compensation systems. State of Alaska, I'm going to use Municipality of Anchorage as an example. I understand that the, and I'm going to use numbers that I'm not really positive of, but the Municipality of Anchorage has a number of bargaining units. I believe it's like 7. If each of those collective bargaining units decided to set up some type of this arrangement, we would have the municipality running 8 different systems, the state system and this little system and this little system. I think we're looking at a system run amok, frankly, to have the ability to have an employer, even a traditional employer who might have some unionized workers and some not. They would be running a dual track of workers' compensation with different rules, different types of entities. Again, these are just general thoughts that I've had. I think it's interesting that we're looking at implementing a new program, and yet a group that was formed by this legislature, the Medical Services Review Committee, has made an extensive report with a lot of recommendations for changes in the system as a whole. And I've not seen any real debate of any of those measures. That's been on our books for a couple years. The committee spent months studying new systems, new ways to develop fee schedules, and a number of recommendations. An example very specifically, there is House Bill 12, which would have proposed the adoption of an advisory committee. And this was, again, one of the Medical Services Review recommendations, to set up a balanced committee to review proposals and make recommendations to the legislature of various types of, in an open and transparent environment, but to serve as a sounding board for the legislature. There have been a number of options put forward to improve our system, including medical treatment guidelines, utilization guidelines. Couple other, and then I'll stop. Although it's not mentioned in SB 116, it appears and it's been stated that the administration of this new exemption program would be through some kind of trust. I've heard that word a lot, but there's nothing in the bill about the trust. I don't know what the trust is. I don't know how it's funded. I don't know if employers pay for that. I have to think somebody pays. And with the system costs that we have today and the insurance cost, I worry we'll be back in number one now that Montana has done the reforms they've done, that Alaska will be back as the highest workers' compensation in the country. It's not a place we want to be number one. SB 116 also provides for the identification of medical treatment providers, medical evaluators, vocational rehabilitation specialists who will be the exclusive source of treatment, but we don't have any guidelines. There aren't any principles or any guidelines. So again, I think we have the potential for a multitude of little groups without any consistency, and that concerns me in an area as critical as workers' compensation. I'd like to see us have a system whose emphasis is on getting an injured worker back to work. I think that's the goal, and I'm not seeing us make very great progress toward that. And with that, I very much appreciate the opportunity to share my musings with you.
Thanks, Director Hall. And did you have any comments on the amendment?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Thank
Director
you.
Hall. Questions for Director Hall? Thanks, Linda. And we do have Paul Grossi signed up. Do you have any comments on the amendment, Mr. Grossi?
Mr. Chair and the committee, for the record, I'm Paul Grossi. I'm here representing the plumbers and pipefitters and also the iron workers. And the only comment I would have is it would, if that amendment goes in, then of course it would eliminate possibilities for potential cost savings in for treatment and health care and that type of thing. So we would be concerned it would basically gut, well, I won't say gut the bill, but would probably make it so that we would not be interested in supporting it any longer, simply because it would take away the potential for a large amount of savings and that's actually what we would consider more effective health treatment.
Great, thank you, Mr. Grossi. Questions, Senator Pascan.
You know, we just heard from the commissioner about a concern with respect to its limited application. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I take it the director is talking about the fact that it doesn't cover all employers and all employees. Well, that's true. I mean, it doesn't, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't be tried, simply because it does, you know, we may not get any employers or employee groups, but the thing is, it's got the potential out there to get 25% of the workforce. But, you know, it also has this potential of providing a sort of pilot project so that maybe there's ways that we can learn from that and extrapolate it into the larger population. So I would say that's not a reason to stop it just because it doesn't have, you know, it doesn't affect everybody. It's you know, got the potential of working for at least a portion, you know, of employers. So say 20, if it's 25% of the workforce, it's probably, you know, somewhere roughly 25% of the, you know, the economy. And I don't know if that's even factual, but anyway, it has, you know, it's a large portion of the economy, so it has that potential out there. So I think it's worth trying. And I would say one other thing about Director Hall's comment about employers and how they may have you know, some employees that would be that could be covered and others that wouldn't, and it would lead to you know, two different systems that they'd have to deal with. But they don't. That's not really an accurate statement, because if an employer thinks that this is not effective for them, they don't have to become part of the group. So they can choose to not become part of it. If they think, well, gee, this will lead to three different types of three systems within my workforce, then I just won't participate. You know, remember, the employer is the other end of the negotiating, is the other side of the negotiating table. So I would think that they can choose for themselves. This is not, there's nothing, no one being forced into this new system. All it is enabling language that will let certain employee groups, certain employers, and doctors the opportunity to do this. But certainly they don't have to. It would just be a matter of choice.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Grazi. Questions for Mr. Grazi?
Just one last, question, and this is on the bottom of page 3, and I don't know whether you're the person to answer it. Bottom of 3, top of page 4, where they talk about competing physicians may meet and compete, and then it says, in the same manner, competing physicians may meet and communicate with the health benefit plan relating to the identity of the health care providers who are the exclusive source. What is your understanding of what the bottom of page 3 and the top of page 4 of the X-ray version, what does that mean?
You know, I can't say that I'm an expert on this type of system, but what it means to me, and you know, it's probably, you'd probably be better to define the legalities of this than me, but what it means to me is doctors can form groups to go in and bid on these types, you know, these systems if they form to get this work. And I guess they'd be permitted to do this by law. And that's what it means to me.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Grazi. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grazi, in my packet here, I have a report from the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, and they were one of the states cited as trying this kind of system. And the report says over and over that the costs actually have gone up in Minnesota over the past few years. And this report is 2009, and there's also some 2010 data here. Have you run any numbers? Alaska has an even smaller pool of health care providers, though we're similar to Minnesota in that Minnesota's kind of rural. But they've got Mayo Clinic and some large universities. We're an even smaller pool of health care providers. Have any numbers been run as far as costs?
Senator Giesel, through the chair, obviously, you know, we don't have those numbers. But I would say this. You know, Director Hall talked about a study in California, and I didn't get a chance to thoroughly study that, but it looked like a relatively small study. It wasn't really an overall. In fact, I think there was one part that just talked about one respondent responding to the study. So I'm not sure if all that's accurate, but get back to Minnesota. You know, it's in relative cost to the rest of the system that you have to look at. My guess is that costs will still go up, you know, but if it goes up, in other words, if it's still less expensive than the, you know, than the alternative, or the current system, or the overall system, then there is a savings, and it's even if it is going up. The other thing I would note is that, well, we don't really have any numbers on workers' comp itself, some of these groups, some of the, you know, the labor groups and their employers have formed a similar systems for their health care benefits, and they have shown savings. So that's why they believe they might be able to work similar systems with workers' comp and have them effective. Now, does that mean that they're still not going to go up in Alaska? Probably, but they're still going to be less expensive than other systems that are performing the same work.
Great, thank you. Further questions, Senator?
Could I ask one more follow-up? So overall, you would regard the work comp system that's in place right now as broken and excessively expensive and slow to settle claims. Would that be true?
Senator Giesel to the chair, I don't know if I would couch it as broken, but I would say that it's becoming more and more expensive. Most of that is because of health care. It's 76% of the cost. And so I think, and also there's some expense in litigation as well. And so if there are at least some potentials out there to try something different, we should try it. And so I would say, I wouldn't say it's broken, but, you know, it may be broke. Yeah, maybe that term can be used sometime in the near future if we don't start doing things. Yeah, and that's not to say that Director Hall, you know, she had some suggestions for potential changes. Maybe those would work too. You know, I don't think this is the one answer to fix the system. I think it's an answer, or at least something we should attempt to do.
Great. Further questions, Mr. Grassi? Seeing none, I do see Mr. Monagle from the Department of Labor in the audience. Mr. Monagle, did you want to provide any testimony from the department? I see you're not signed up. Mr. Monagle, make it quick.
For the record, my name is Mike Monagle. I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. Through the chair, just a couple of quick observations. Director Hall had mentioned that the cost of medical benefits in the workers' comp system, and I think the committee is aware of those costs, and we've been running back and forth with the state of Montana for the last 10 years over who's number one and number two in the country on workers' comp costs. Yeah. Last year, Montana was able to put in place some serious reforms for medical costs, and as a result of those reforms, the rating organization, NCCI, which is also the rating organization for the state of Alaska, lowered the premium costs in the state of Montana by 25%. So I have no doubt that when the premium studies come out this year, Alaska will be, unfortunately, number one in the country on workers' comp costs. As far as the CS for this bill, a couple of high-level observations. As the director, one of the comments I get quite often from injured workers is that the system is difficult to navigate and complex. My fear is if we add a carve-out system, if we add alternatives, we complicate the system, we don't simplify it. Often pro se litigants will come to us and ask us for direction on their rights. My fear is that instead of being able to direct workers on how to pursue their rights under the Workers' Comp Act, I would have to tell them to go talk to the union representative and see what their collective bargaining agreement allows. So it, in my mind, adds complexity to the system instead of simplifying it. As far as the selection of medical doctors goes, I don't see any incentive under this process for costs to come down. As the Healthcare Commission's study that just came out noted, the biggest cost driver to the system was lack of competition. And just because you have a list of doctors who step forward to say we're interested in participating, I don't see that equating to an incentive to reduce their fees. And quite honestly, unless we do something to reduce fees, I don't see any changes to the medical costs in the workers' comp system. And then finally, let me just say that, you know, part of the legislation presupposes that a carve-out will reduce costs. And as Director Hall mentioned, there was a 2002 study from University of Berkeley, but also there was a study that came out in February of 2012 by the state of California looking at carve-outs, and they concluded that there was no significant differences between rates for a carve-out employer and the rates for an employer who received their benefits through the insurance marketplace. They did note that there was no evidence overall that carve-outs have resulted in premium rate reductions, and I've looked extensively, and I've yet to find a single study that says carve-outs will, in fact, reduce workers' comp rates.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Monagle. Questions for Mr. Monagle? Senator Pascal.
Briefly, you know, what I'm, I guess, struggling with at the moment is the concept of if we have a chance at reducing costs, even if they are administrative costs as compared to the medical costs, you know, what I've heard is if the employer and the unit don't want it, they don't have to agree to it. But if you can if you can reduce even the administrative cost portion of it, you got a chance. And so what I'm struggling with that, because then there's always the upside that you might even reduce the medical costs a little bit. So help me with that.
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Pasvan, I think when you say the administrative costs, I believe you're talking about the mediation of disputes.
Yes, exactly. So, you resolve the dispute quickly without lawyers, so to speak.
Right.
You know, both sides don't lawyer up.
And again, I'll refer to the recent California study, which concluded that there was no difference in the number of disputes in the carve-out process versus disputes under the workers' comp claim system. And our system, although it's not in statute, we already do mediations. We do, I think this last year, we did approximately 60 mediations. One of the things that is concerning about the process is, although the bill doesn't mandate mediation, it does say once you choose to mediate, once that mediation process is broken off either by the hearing officer or the parties, it must go to arbitration. And I think that process does add cost to the system. I don't think that simplifies it. And one of the concerns about the committee substitute is that in the prior version, there was an appellate provision that said that the arbitrator's decision could be appealed to the Workers' Comp Appeals Commission. I did not see that in the CS. So it would seem as though the arbitrator's decision would be final. So I do think that could potentially lead to some additional administrative costs.
Great, thank you. And we're out of time, and I apologize, Mr. Monagle. I think we have some questions we need to answer before we take Senator Diesel's amendment and direct the CS. So we'll address your amendment, BAX X.1, and then we'll work on the CS / X as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Monagle. That concludes the meeting of Labor and Commerce for